Hello and welcome to the Mejlis Podcast, radio for Europe current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Bruce Pannier, host of the Mejlis and author of the weekly Central Asia in Focus newsletter. For some 30 years, Kyrgyzstan has had the reputation of being the most democratic country in Central Asia. There have been upheavals, including three revolutions since 2005, but political opposition was tolerated, civil society was vibrant, and an independent media was able to continue working. But lately, the government of President Sadir Japarov operated under a new constitution approved in 2021 that gives the president sweeping powers, has been clamping down on all three of those things. Transparency International released its annual Corruption Perceptions Index at the end of January and said of Kyrgyzstan, quote, "While it used to be a democratic outlier among its neighbors, the country has slid toward autocracy. The resulting weakening of checks and balances is making it increasingly easy for those with power to abuse it without accountability," unquote. In this session of the Mejlis Podcast, we're going to look at what's been happening in Kyrgyzstan. And to discuss all this, I am joined by Gulnaza Said, head of the Europe and Central Asia Program at the Committee to Protect Journalists, Sinat Sultanaliyeva, Central Asia researcher for Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan at Human Rights Watch. And let me mention, Sinat is the author of the recently published book, Nomadity of Being, Narratives of Kyrgyzstani Women's Rights Activists. And Bakit Bashimov, who is currently teaching at Northwestern University, but was a former member of Kyrgyzstan's parliament, also a former Kyrgyz ambassador to the OSCE and to India. So thank you all for joining me today. And Sinat, since you're out there, I want to start with you. What have you been seeing? I mean, we certainly will get into Bulat Timirov, who dates back a little bit further, but really since October, there's been a sharp shift in the policies of the government, I would say. What are you seeing when you're out there?
Yes, thank you, Bruce, for having me here again. Well, I would say, as you mentioned already, of course, there are specific cases against journalists, and I think we've discussed it previously as well, or it's been raised a lot of the times. But some of the things that we're noticing, and specifically in terms of the policy or like politics of the government, is I guess it's something that does happen, but it's just, you know, it just seems absurd that there are two NGO laws, for example, in Kyrgyzstan currently sort of up for consideration. There is one law or draft law on that would be sort of revising the old law on non-commercial organizations, so NCOs and NGOs. And then there's another one that's been initiated by the member of the parliament, Nadira Narmatova, and it's basically the foreign agents draft law. And I mean, she's not using the foreign agents term. I think it's the word that's being, or the concept that's being used is a foreign representative. But still, you know, the text remains the same. Basically, you could say. So these are pretty big indications of where the country is nowadays, I think, and including also the court cases against Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberties, Kyrgyz Service, Azatlik Media here in Kyrgyzstan. Yeah, it's crazy.
Thank you. And Gulnaza, if you could give us a little more information about the media. I mean, thank you, Sinat, for mentioning Azatlik, but it's not just Azatlik. And actually, some of the early signs that there was problems came last year with Bulat Timirov. Can you speak about the cases that have affected the media in Kyrgyzstan?
Yes. Hi, Bruce. It's a very good question and a very timely one, because just on January 31st, we at CPJ and several other international organizations, including Human Rights Watch, sent a letter to President Japarov raising concerns about, expressing our concerns about the press freedom situation in Kyrgyzstan. And Azatlik is one of the cases that we mentioned in the letter. And also the other, there are several other cases. Bulat Timirov, as you know, an investigative journalist who was deported to Russia. And that was a way for the authorities to silence him and to stop his investigative reporting into high-level official corruption. And several other incidents, for example, director of broadcaster Next TV, Talaybek Dushimbaev, was handed a suspended five-year sentence. Cactus Media is under a criminal investigation, and today we heard the news that the Ministry of Culture wants to shut Klopp down. And Klopp is another well-known investigative reporting project. The situation with these media outlets and in general, the general mood in the environment is very negative for independent media right now. We hear these calls to now not just shut some media outlets down, but also, as Sinat mentioned, the so-called foreign media legislation that can impact many media outlets. I don't know if we can still call Kyrgyzstan as an island of democracy as it used to be known earlier in the days, because what we see is a very negative trend in terms of press freedom.
Okay, thank you. Bakit, you've been a guest on our show before when we've talked about Sadir Japarov and his inner circle, and of course that the government is been going on. Are you surprised at, one, are you surprised at what's going on now? You know, we've kind of talked about that before, but do you see, is there any reason why, you know, like I said, since October, there seems to be greater activity on the part of the government at removing critics and opponents?
Thank you, Bruce, for the invitation to this program. First of all, recently, Azatik released an interesting program about the main promises of Sadir Japarov during his inauguration and during his meetings with the people. And among them, he promised firmly never attack a free press, and secondly, never persecute people who think differently than him or those who is in power. And of course, you ask this question, why he is doing that? The man and his close friend, Kamchibek Tashiev, who is the head of the security committee, why they turn their promises and acting against their, let's say, political philosophy? I explain by two main factors. First of all, These guys who is in power, Sadir Japarov as a president and Kamchibek Tashiev as a head of National Security Committee, they are heading to the populist trap. They promise a law and they promise people to fulfill many complicated things during a short period of time. And they supported by the people. And until now, their supporters trying to push forward their agenda, and despite their problems, they continue to support him. But also a lot of people started to worry. And they are asking, when you'll start to fulfill your promises? And these guys started to understand that they cannot fulfill many of their promises. And in order to just get out from this trap, we're trying to attack free press. I explained Temirov persecution by this factor bit because he started to reveal a lot of interesting things. From one side, Sadir Japarov and his close associates appear in public in very luxury dresses, very expensive dresses. On the other side, we are trying to explain people that they will fight against poverty and they return all labor migrants from Russia. No. They, especially in Russia, Kyrgyz labor migrants started to ask when you will fulfill your promise. And second factor, after these gatherings with the Central Asian authoritarian leaders and Putin and Lukashenko, they started to think that Kyrgyz regime should not be outlier and should be similar to their regimes. Yeah, I see here some kind of external pressure on them, and probably this is external pressure of authoritarian leaders, and their interests today were coinciding. And that's why they are trying to convert Kyrgyzstan into the authoritarian country.
Great, thank you very much. Sinat, I want to get back to you and get in. We've heard some of the names of the media outlets, for instance, that have been come under pressure lately. But I want to talk about the actual process of pressuring some of these people too, including the civil activists, you know, the Computerbot Reservoir Committee that was opposing that deal. There's 27 people that they picked up, 24 remain in custody. Some of them said that they have never been questioned by investigators or haven't been questioned since right after they were put in, and they doubt that there's even an investigation going on. At the same time, the government says the investigation is secret, and so they can't release any details of that. What can you shed some light on that at all?
I couldn't possibly shed some light on that. I mean, in terms of what's going on behind that stuff, right? Because, but I could probably comment on how that is a procedural violation, and that's definitely a human rights violation, of course, by the state. And it's just something that's very interesting is that the whole Computerbot deal was also a secret affair, right? Nobody knows still to this day, even after the deal has been signed, most likely, with the recent visit of President Mirziyoyev to Kyrgyzstan. And so it's really no surprise that all the proceedings related to this case have been also made secret. They have become classified case. And what I would say is that this is another, I guess, a symptom of this downward spiral that Kyrgyzstan is on the past 2 years, you could say, actually. Because the whole making a case secret behind closed doors and that kind of stuff, this is actually comes from the toolbox of the presence from the more previously more authoritarian and more dictatorial states in Central Asia. Specifically, I'm referring to Tajikistan. Like, for example, majority of the cases in Tajikistan, the court hearings and investigations that had to do with political dissidents or, let's say, with the Gorno-Badakhshan Autonomous Oblast, right? And basically everything else. The main thing is the state will just declare all these cases a secret, confidential, classified, and there's just no way for the international community to go in and to monitor these cases. I can personally say that I've been trying to try and go and see the people who are behind bars with the Computerbot case. And every time that I would reach, you know, through their colleagues or somebody else, I would be just told that, you know, the only people who are allowed to see them are their relatives, direct blood relatives, you could say. So anybody else is just unable to go there and, you know, talk to them to get information about their cases, because you're just going to, you know, face the wall of secrecy. And that's something that's extremely problematic. And it's just also showing, like I already said, right, that this is very symptomatic of something bad happening in Kyrgyzstan.
Okay, thank you. Gulnaza, same basic question for you about some of the media. I remember when Bulat Temirov trial was underway, even last May, his lawyer said that he couldn't get access to some of the evidence against his client because the government also declared that secret and wouldn't give it up. Azatix has had a hard time getting information on exactly what they're being charged with and where this information came from, why their bank accounts were frozen, things like that. Can you talk a little bit about that? What kind of due process of law some of these media outlets have received?
Yes, there have been procedural violations in practically every case, and for some reason we have seen more secrecy around the cases that was not the case in Kyrgyzstan a few years ago, for example. You already mentioned Bulat Temirov. You know, the prosecution of Temirov from the very start was marred with irregularities and, as I said, procedural violations. The very fact that he was deported to Russia under a very technical reason, that he simply holds a Russian citizenship, although he had not lived there for a long time, was a very clear attempt of the authorities to silence him and to stop him from continuing his investigative reporting. And as it was already mentioned, Temirov did dig out some truth about various high-level officials, including the head of the security services, which is a risky business even in Kyrgyzstan. And now we have a proof of that. And when it comes to Azatik, there are multiple hearings like the one that took place today on February the 2nd, and then there is another one next week scheduled for February the 9th, and there are multiple issues that Azatec has to deal with. It's not just the blocking of its website, but also the bank accounts being frozen and the criminal investigation, which is also not very clear. And we at CPJ have been in touch with the representative of Azatec, of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, on a regular basis since this case or cases started. And we've been trying to get the most up-to-date information, and it is very unclear not just how the whole process has been going on, but also how it will proceed and the political nature of it, and also the calls that we hear that Azatec should be closed down, that its bureau in Kyrgyzstan should be closed down, is definitely an attempt to silence this very prominent media outlet.
Okay, thank you. And Bakit, one, for the benefit of our audience who might not know as much about Kyrgyzstan as you three do, one, I would like to speak a little bit about the judiciary and its independence, if there is any independence from the executive branch. But I'm also kind of curious your thoughts, since you've been, I mean, you've seen all of Kyrgyzstan's history. Do you remember anything similar from any previous governments, like the crackdown we're seeing now in Kyrgyzstan?
Actually, Bruce, it is a very important topic. There is no independent judiciary in Kyrgyzstan, and in that political environment, it is impossible. I experienced that personally. In the 90s, when I was a member of parliament, I spent almost half a year going to the court and persecuted by the police at that time. And since then, I'm closely analyzing the situation, and it is impossible in that political culture, in that environment, to have even a little bit independent judiciary. Why? When it goes to civil issues in the courts and so on, you can see that mostly these issues resolve on the basis of bribery or kingship, or influence by our people, and it's difficult. I personally experienced with also being involved in several issues. After that, all those who were in power in the Sadr Japarov and Kamchibek Tashiev were using courts and judiciary system in order to persecute those who are against them. And it seems to me it is civilizational issue. And I don't think that in a, let's say, foreseeable future, it is possible, because there is no attempts to make this courts and judicial system more independent. It's just one sector of life of a society where people who are directly involved in them, they're making it some kind of source of wealth. It's a lucrative business for people who are involved in that. And it's lucrative also for those who are in power, who are using them in order to persecute. You can see during this Akayev, Bakiyev, and after that Atambayev, and today in Sadr Japarov's times, they are using this court all against their own opponents. Thank you.
Okay, great, thanks. You know, and we've reached the halfway point in our discussion, so it is time for me to remind that this is the Mejlis podcast, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Bruce Pinner, host of the Mejlis and author of the weekly Central Asia in Focus newsletter. We're talking about the recent government crackdown on political opposition, civil society, and independent media in Kyrgyzstan. And joining me to talk about this are Sinat Sultanaliyeva, Central Asia researcher for Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan at Human Rights Watch, Bakit Bashimov, a former member of Kyrgyzstan's parliament, also a former Kyrgyz ambassador to the OSCE, who currently teaches at Northeastern University, and Gulnaz Saeed, head of the Europe and Central Asia program at the Committee to Protect Journalists. Bakit, I'm going to start with you on this part. you know, you'd mentioned earlier that Kyrgyzstan, you feel Kyrgyzstan is being pressured a little bit by some of the other countries in Belarus, Russia, countries that it's in other organizations with. Which foreign factors or foreign influences do you think are pushing the Kyrgyz government in the direction they're going, if any, and which domestic? You mentioned also that, you know, they play to the nationalist base, but can you talk about foreign and domestic support for Kyrgyz Sadr Japarov's current course of political activities?
Yes, domestic factors, it's supporters of Sadr Japarov, Khanchabek Tashiev. After that, it's conservative religious people, and you can see among a new generation, a lot of people becoming conservative religious, and they are pushing forward. And after that, a few months ago, Sadr Japarov organized Kurultai. It's a big gathering of people who came from the different provinces and expressed their opinion. And in that Kurultai, it was very visible that these people for order, as they say, it should be iron order. And iron order, I understand, as a rule of one man, strong man. And it is so sad that all these people didn't learn lesson from the previous presidencies and didn't make a very good conclusions. And external factors, I see that in international relations, beginning of formation of different blocs. And Putin, of course, facing defeat in Ukraine, trying to consolidate his support. And today we can see that Central Asia is only region where he can be welcomed and accepted as a powerful leader. That's why. It's, after that, all neighbors, leader of Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Tokayev, they are trying to also to make this region, more safe from these vulnerabilities of current period. And in that sense, it seems to me the close discussions brought Sadr Japarov to the opinion that it's important not to stay as an outlier, as an island of democracy, but to be together with the neighbors.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Sinat, I have a question for you. Kyrgyzstan has a reputation, and really it's true, has always been true, that people come out and protest or demonstrate or rally for something, you know, really almost all the time. It seems like, you know, certainly no month goes by without reports of somebody rallying, whether it's local problems to do with, some local company or finding employment or corruption or something, you know. But I mean, Kyrgyzstan became a culture of, you know, protests and demonstrations. But it seems quiet lately. That is strange. I don't see reports about people coming out to demonstrate. Am I just missing these reports, or is that really the case that people aren't, for some reason, aren't demonstrating or rallying about anything?
Well, I think that's a correct feeling, because I'm also thinking about this, and it just feels like everybody's sort of focusing on the imminent threats that are coming from the legal, well, the legislative, right, branch, and others. But I'm thinking myself back into 2022, basically. And, well, there were some protests that were mostly focused, they were mostly localized in Bishkek, and they would be the meetings that would be organized by several, by one or two of the reformer-related groups, like Bashtan Bashta or something else, you know, to sort of react, right? So reactionary kind of protest with quite a political agenda. Well, I would say maybe a democratization, free speech, freedom of assembly, that kind of stuff. But I think you're right in that the government seems to have, at least temporarily, I hope it's temporarily, succeeded in kind of scaring everyone into, you know, thinking twice, let's say, before going into, before organizing a protest, especially in the second half of the year. And I would say in that sense, the Kempirabad case is probably a very emblematic kind of a case, even though the people weren't even able to go to the protest, right? Like they were they were all arrested before this. And then there was sort of like a walking march, like people coming out to the streets to kind of protest the fact that they were detained ahead of the march and stuff like that. But this has definitely sent a very anxiety-inducing message to the civil society, I guess, or like to the people who have a more activist kind of a stance towards things that are happening. Another thing that might have to do with this is actually, now that I'm remembering it, is that we still have, at least in Bishkek, there is still the ongoing protest ban, the blanket protest ban that was introduced back in April, I think, last year. Then it was extended for a few months. Then it was extended through autumn, then through December. And now it's been extended again till, I think, till April. And then recently another district in Bishkek. So it's not completely the whole of Bishkek. I think it's Pirmaisky district and then the Sverdlov district. If I'm correct, I mean, I may have mixed up some of those. But there are two, basically half of Bishkek is now closed for any kind of protest. And that's something that's also adding into this. But then again, I missed this completely. I read it later on, but apparently there was also, there was a meeting yesterday or the day before here in Bishkek, in the place that was, you know, designated by the authorities for to hold the protest. Because of course the blanket ban is not just that you cannot conduct any kind of protest, but they have identified one or two spots in within the city that's far away from people, from the masses, basically. And so there has been a protest there, but it looks like it's a protest of people who may be somehow related to the regime, I would say, because obviously the main message was close down the Soros Foundation, close down Azatik, close down all of these foreign-supported organizations, you know, that kind of stuff. So as you can see, so some protests are still being allowed, other protests are being nipped in the bud.
Okay, thank you. You know, and it kind of says something that I know they have a ban on protests and they put one in, you know, for Bishkek that it lasted a few months, but I can remember, it, you know, it's been 15 or 20 years, but those bans never made any difference. The government would say you can't block the road, and the next day people would go out and block the road anyway. So I guess it's...
I would probably add to this... But potentially, I hope that nobody from the government or, like, you know, from the more vindictive side of the government is listening to this podcast. Let's hope not. But my thinking, my feeling personally, like anecdotal evidence, let's say, right? Talking to people, what might have also played a role is how Bulatimira, for example, has been dealt with. Because that's exactly what's happened. He's been dealt with by those in power. Because he really got on their nerves, and this was extremely retaliatory. It's very obvious it was retaliatory. And the way he was expulsed from the country, like basically just, you know, from the room, from the courtroom, and then he was just, you know, taken to the airport, not allowed to take anything with him, and just sent out of the country. This also sent a very clear message that, you know, don't mess with us. We're an angry bunch. And I feel that this may have also kind of made it difficult for people to not heed the, you know, the warning and you know, not follow the protest ban and stuff like that. I mean, this is just a speculation, honestly, but could be something related to that.
Oh, it's a good explanation, but I think you're onto something there without a doubt. Gulnaz, I have a question for you too. You guys always try to deal with the governments involved and get comments and stuff from them. Have you been able to make contact with the Kyrgyz government and ask them questions about why they're moving against independent media outlets?
If I may, Bruce, go just a step back and speak about the protests. And I'm glad to not mention the protests that took place earlier this week in Bishkek, in which we heard calls for foreign agent law, and the protesters singled out the Soros Foundation and wanted it to be closed, as Sinat said. And that's very concerning because, as it was pointed out, first of all, the protest itself seems to be government orchestrated. And secondly, from monitoring many different countries across Eurasia, I can say that whenever there are calls to close the Soros Foundation branches in a country, that's usually a serious slide towards autocracy. And we have seen that in Central and Eastern Europe, in Hungary, for example, in other countries, and now we are seeing it in Kyrgyzstan. And Kyrgyzstan has been known as a country with more freedoms and more independent media outlets. And one of the criteria I usually use when I look at the development of journalism in a country is exactly the kind of investigative reporting local media outlets can conduct, because investigative reporting is something very complex. It's time consuming. It is resource consuming. And Kyrgyzstan has been known for several media outlets, not just Azatik, that's supported by the U.S., but also local media outlets like KLOP, who have done investigative reporting. And I think it's important to understand that journalists who do that, everybody in the society benefits from their work. The journalists do a very important work, beneficial for the entire society. And it's very concerning that the Kyrgyz authorities are trying to not just shut down those media outlets, but also to change the legislative base. And going back to your question, we have been trying to contact the Kyrgyz authorities. We write to them, to many different government institutions in charge of the media, or say prosecutor general's office and so on, every time there is a press freedom violation in Kyrgyzstan, every time we publish a statement expressing our concerns and calling on the authorities to act in a more supportive for independent media way. Unfortunately, we haven't been hearing back from Kyrgyz authorities officially. Of course, we have made contacts with some government officials who may say, you know, it's not like they're not seeing our messages. They see them. And I mentioned the letter we sent on Tuesday to President Japarov, expressing concerns and requesting a meeting with him and other government officials, because we believe that the situation is so serious that it is Japarov himself who should get involved in ensuring press freedom in Kyrgyzstan, but also because the system has become so vertical with every decision going to Japarov and his level, with little independence left with the judiciary, as it was already mentioned, that it's very important that Japarov fulfills all his personal promises that he expressed when he was running for presidency, but also his and his country's obligations as a member of the international community. Again, Kyrgyzstan has not been responsive to our calls in any way, unfortunately.
Okay, thanks. Bikit, of course, you're welcome to comment on any of that you want. But
I would like just to catch the last point expressed by Gulnoza. She said that the Kyrgyz government is not responsive. And I see in that, in responsiveness of Kyrgyz government, their own logic. Today we can see one thing is becoming dominant in their decision-making process. It is securitization of domestic politics and even foreign policy. When we look at their supporters and analyze speeches of Sadir Japarov and Kamchibek Tashiev today, we can see that they are explaining this securitization by the two important things. First, they explain it to their own people and especially their supporters, telling that Kyrgyzstan actually in the state of war with Tajikistan, and that's why it is important to consolidate all efforts. And those who are against Sadir Japarov, we are undermining stability in Kyrgyzstan and the better preparation of Kyrgyzstan to resist against the aggressor. And we can see the continuation of this securitization to some kind of militarization. And that's why a lot of their supporters are thinking that just to get a new weaponry and to make an army more strong today is more important than free press or just opinions of people who differently. After that, in a foreign policy, we are thinking that given this kind of a situation, it's probably upcoming war with Tajikistan. It is important to make relations with our neighbors more reliable. That's why we push forward. This is a delimitation of the border with Uzbekistan, explaining to people that to have very reliable, trustworthy relations with Uzbekistan as a one of the dominant powers in the region, it's vital for Kyrgyzstan's security. And that's why they put the label of secrecy on Camp Rabat issue. And I will not surprise if they will continue to be irresponsive. They will continue to keep in secrecy many issues, and their supporters will continue to support this kind of securitization of Kyrgyzstan. How long they will do that, it's uncertain.
Thank you very much. Okay, and we are running to the end, so I'm going to give everyone a chance to make one last comment, pretty much whatever you want, kind of in the back of your mind, if you can keep the thought about where is this government gone past the point of no return, so to speak? I mean, as long as Japarov's in, is this all we can hope for from his kind of government as far as you can see? But it's the floor is free to you to comment on any aspect of Kyrgyzstan you wish. Gulnaz, I'll start with you.
Sure. Bruce, we have been in touch with representatives of the European governments, with the US government on Kyrgyzstan, and there is an awareness about the deteriorating press freedom situation in Kyrgyzstan. So it's not happening in isolation. And I think it's very important that the Kyrgyz authorities are aware of that, of a potential reaction from foreign governments. And some foreign officials expressed their concern on this. For example, a U.S. diplomat in Bishkek, the ambassador, but also others have been aware. So, and the political situation, the situation with political freedoms, including press freedom, is always a condition for foreign investments, and I'm sure Kyrgyzstan knows it better than many other Central Asian countries because it has extensive relations with foreign governments, foreign companies, and also has had to rely on foreign investments extensively in its history of independence. And that's why I want to reiterate that it is very important to ensure political freedoms and liberties in Kyrgyzstan, including press freedom, and stop these repressions against independent media.
Thank you. Sina?
I mean, I agree with everything that Gulnaza has said here, but one thing that I think it's important to remember in addition here, and I think so basically the important thing is, even though it feels like we are plunging into sort of darkness currently, and I certainly feel like that sometimes, especially in the mornings when I'm reading the news and, yet again, another restrictive legislative initiative is being started or something like that. But then I remember that, throughout these 30 years in Kyrgyzstan, the country has gone through similar situations. And, if you go back to the few years before, the last few years of Akayev's regime or the last few years in Bakiyev's regime and others, there have been much worse situations. And the civil society has persevered and has stood up to this. But one thing that is very important to remember is that this civil society is like, it cannot just always be there standing up, especially when you remember, when you know that it's the same people There is such a thing as activist burnout, civil society burnout, and in a situation when international sort of partners of the country and donor agencies and others have kind of made this move out of the rural areas, not in terms of out of rural areas, but like out of this supporting democratization processes, supporting civil society formation and that kind of stuff, right? It is difficult, like, because then we are leaving the civil society with just the people who are already in there. And considering that the situation is getting worse, the space for civil society is shrinking, of course, you know, there won't be new people, or there will be a lot less new people coming in to activism, to political activism, and, you know, rights activism in general. So I think it is important to remember that, of course, this is not, there is still hope. But I think it's important to remember that we need to support more the grassroots activists and civil society in general, especially in light of this kind of continuing attack on the idea of civil society in Kyrgyzstan.
Thank you. And we'll get to you. Same question. Is the course of the Japarov government set and there's no turning back for this? Or are there other factors that might change what he's doing?
You know, Bruce, there is a hope, should be the hope. Why? Because this current Kyrgyz regime is heading to the populist trap. And soon, I expect by the end of this year, we'll be completing this trap. And that's why it's so important to continue to support civil society, social activists, and free press. Time will come soon for them. And that's why I see that this regime will just repeat to some extent destiny of the previous regime, will collapse, and after it we will open new page.
That's a good way to leave it. Perfect. Okay, I'm sure we're going to be getting back to the topic of Kyrgyzstan probably a lot sooner than all of us wish. It would be nice if things would start going in a more positive direction sometime soon, but we'll see. So I want to say thank you to Bakit, Gulnaza, and Sinat for being on the program today. And a big thank you to Nathan Shoemaker, our Mejlis podcast producer in Washington, D.C. And a reminder, you can subscribe to the Mejlis podcast or the Central Asia in Focus newsletter by visiting Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's website at rfarl.org. Thank you very much. We'll be back next week. Bye-bye.